Okay.
Hopefully that's recording now. So, good afternoon.
Hello.
My name's Paul Winspear. I'm the Chief Executive of Western Hospice Care, a hospice that supports people with life-limiting illnesses in parts of Somerset and North Somerset. I'm sitting here today with John, who prior to the COVID pandemic was one of our special team of reception volunteers, giving of his time to us freely every week and helping out with the many tasks that occupy a busy hospice reception. But more recently, John is now one of our patients after being diagnosed with myeloma, which is a rare bone marrow cancer. So hi, John. Thank you so much for agreeing to come in today and chat to me. And it's lovely to see you again. It's the first time I've seen you since you were diagnosed with myeloma. So first of all, I just wanted to ask you how you're feeling and how you're coping.
I'm doing quite well now. I've had about 6 months of chemo, which has been tough going. My blood level results now are so low that we're looking probably in the next month at a stem cell transplant, which then should lead me into a long period of remission, I hope.
Okay. So wish you all the very best with that. And that's taking place sometime in July, is that right?
That's the hope, at Bristol, yes.
Okay. And you mentioned before that this would be the second stem cell transplant that you'd had, and that the first one had given you a decent period of remission.
Yeah, I had my first stem cell transplant back in July 2006. So I've had 7 years relatively symptom-free remission, which is quite long, and I hope to have the same sort of period again. If I'm lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I understand from watching the video that you kindly shared, the short film that you made with Myeloma UK. I don't personally know very much about myeloma, but I understand that having a sort of a previous diagnosis of MGUS is an indicator that it could develop. All the same, it must have come as such a shock to actually get that diagnosis.
Yeah, I thought when I was told in 2005, shortly after the sudden death of my first partner, that was a shock. But despite being told that it could be a lead into myeloma, when I actually then got the diagnosis of myeloma in November 2013, it was like being hit by a train still, really. And I'd gone in there for the appointment with my doctor, Mark, his name was, lovely chap. But I'd gone in on my own. Danny, my husband, who I've been with for 16 years now, didn't come with me because we weren't really expecting.
Expecting that kind of news.
Yeah. So, quite how I got home, I'm not quite sure really, because I think I was in a bit of a daze. And then I can remember when I walked through the door, the first things I said to Danny was, "I've got cancer." And he fell into my arms, and I literally had to hold him up. So it was a terrible, terrible shock. For both of us, really, even though we knew it was a possibility.
Yeah, and I guess the striking thing about that is that here we are in the hospice, and we have so many patients that we see who go through a similar kind of experience, and for some of them it comes as a shock, and it just makes you think again, all over again, about how many people are going through that kind of shock to the system. I mean, you use the words being hit like a train and how that feels, and it's such a reminder. I mean, talking to you about what people are going through when they're first diagnosed, and I know that one thing we've tried to do is to meet people earlier in their in their end of life journey and provide more support. Mm. But what's it like, John, in the first few weeks after a diagnosis? I mean, where do you go for support or to get information? What was that like?
When Mark, the doctor, gave me the diagnosis, he gave me a handful of leaflets for all sorts of organisations, along with stuff he printed off himself on the cancer, and then said immediately, you know, I'll give you a few days and we'd like to start you next week on chemo. And I said, look, that's just, I'm holding my hands up now, saying, that's just a bit too much, too soon for me, really. Yes, I'd like to do a bit of research, but first and foremost, I want to put myself and my husband first.
Yeah.
And could we have a quick break before I start on the chemo? Can you give me a couple of weeks or something?
Absolutely, yeah.
He said yes, and we were fortunate enough to be able to book a week's holiday in Barbados at very short notice.
Fantastic.
Which was great and just what I needed, really. And then as soon as we got back, I looked through the leaflets. Myeloma UK came up as the one, really, that I should contact, probably along with Macmillan. I have to say that Myeloma UK were absolutely incredible. They have a wealth of information which they can send out by email and also in the post. And they have a telephone line that is manned at least 5 days a week by specialist nurses who can talk to you and give advice, and they're great. And I'd also add that, that Myeloma UK, along with Western Hospice Care, are the two charities that I've chosen to leave gifts to in my will.
That's fantastic.
Because I'm so grateful to both organisations.
Thank you very much. And this week, I've actually discovered this very week that we're meeting is my Myeloma Awareness Week. So
yes,
I guess it's a cancer that most people probably don't know very much about. But would you like us to tell a little bit about it, John, and the prognosis for yourself?
It's a relatively rare cancer, although it's becoming better known now. Unfortunately, the mortality rate on diagnosis is quite high, and that's because probably most GPs would only see maybe two or three patients in their working career with myeloma on average. And so they're not really looking out for the symptoms of myeloma, you know, which could be bone pain, which of course, given that myeloma tends to affect people mostly of a certain age and over. I mean, I'm 62, I think I had my diagnosis quite early, and that's because I went for a test for prostate, and although that was cleared, they picked up an anomaly in my blood,
right,
which led to the diagnosis of Engus.
Yeah.
So I was very, very fortunate.
Yeah.
But most patients who are elderly have been going to their GPs and mentioning symptoms of, you know, bone pain, fatigue, the sorts of things that GPs would put down to old age, arthritis, rheumatism.
Yeah.
And so they're not followed up.
Mm.
And so Myeloma UK are constantly trying to push with GPs what they should be looking out for, so that patients can be diagnosed earlier and therefore have a better prognosis.
Okay. And I mean, your own experience just shows the benefit in general of going for a health screening, in your case prostate, but you know, just for it could be anything.
Yeah. And I'd like to mention again, as a slight aside, how grateful I was a couple of years ago when I reached my 60th birthday, and it coincided with a wing walk that that you were doing to raise money for the hospice.
Yeah.
And you generously allowed me to join that wing walk to raise money for Myeloma UK.
Fantastic.
So thank you for
great.
That.
Great. And you're still here to tell the tale.
Yes.
Would you say then, John, that Myeloma UK have been the main resource that has been able to signpost you through your journey? And sort of, it often occurs that it must be quite baffling trying to navigate the health system and to know where to go for yes. help and support.
Yeah, I would say probably Myeloma UK gave me advice on how to approach my GP as well, and how to speak to my GP and my consultant about various things, because
right.
I always think the patient-doctor relationship has changed over the last few decades, from being one where the doctor told you what to do and you were grateful to be told what to do, to a sort of 50-50 relationship, really. And in fact, they'd probably say it was the other way around, more in my favour now.
Yeah.
Because I've got a bit of a medical background.
Right.
So I tend to go in perhaps a bit more confidently than most patients.
Yeah.
It's Myeloma UK was very helpful at signposting, and but my GP put me in touch then with my local hospice, which in Worcester, St. Richard's Hospice, and like Western Hospice Care, they were extremely helpful in allowing me to have a number of complementary therapies, which included massage and meditation.
Right.
And I was lucky enough also at the hospital where I was receiving treatment to be offered reflexology. All those things were excellent, because I'm a great believer, and it's something that I said very much when I sat on a panel for the NHS. I'm a great believer in treating every part of the patient.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think can be forgotten. I think the various parties have to be reminded about that.
And has that been your experience both of St. Richard's and of Western Hospice Care?
Yeah, of course, you know, I think the mentality of hospices these days are that they're not just places to go to die.
Yeah.
I think we all, as people and as patients, we all have very similar needs in common. We all want to love and be loved. We want to be treated with respect and dignity. And that's also how we want to die, with respect and dignity, and with the people that we love around us.
Yeah.
I certainly think that both St. Richard's Hospice and Western Hospice Care have been marvellous in their approach. And speaking as a gay man, if I need to speak that way, I feel as though I've been treated like anybody else, which is exactly how it should be. If anyone in the LGBTQ community who's listening to this has any fears or apprehensions about their futures and about whether or not they may need to consider taking up the many things that are on offer from a hospice, then they should have no fear, because I've been extremely proud to be associated with the hospice, both as a volunteer and as a patient.
And I think that gives you quite a unique perspective, having, you know, helped us as a volunteer and now as a patient, you've seen the hospice from both sides. So the insight you're giving us is really valuable for that reason. Do you feel like, John, I mean, you've been very open with us from the start that you were in a same-sex relationship with your husband. Do you feel like amongst the LGBTQ community, I mean, not everyone is as open as you are. Do you think we need to do more to reach out to that community so that people who maybe are at a different point would still feel welcome by the hospice? Or
yeah, that's a difficult question. That's a good question, difficult question. For those people who are gay, who aren't out.
Mm.
It's difficult to know what can be done to, you know, you're not trying to get those people to come out if they don't want to come out.
Sure.
It would be, I would imagine that you would probably want to attend gay functions like Gay Pride, have a stand at Gay Pride, something like that.
Yes.
Make other efforts to contact the gay community through local gay press.
Yeah.
There are various national and local gay newspapers, which I'm sure you're aware of. I think it would be good, yes, to have a presence in those.
Okay.
If indeed, I guess you, do you have a presence in press per se? You do, don't you? You advertise.
We do, yes, local. We do. I'm not aware though that we have particularly reached out to those to that local gay press. So although we've participated in Pride in Western each year, and we'll do so again this year with Pride just around the corner, I'm not sure we've done that. So that's a really good suggestion that I'll follow up on and have a look at.
Yeah.
Because we know that we're here for everybody, regardless of, you know, race, religion, background, sexual preference, any other protected characteristics.
Yeah.
But it's one thing to say it, isn't it? And it's another thing for us to really live that out, to make sure that we are reaching out to those other communities, whether it's the homeless community or the LGBTQ community or different ethnicities or religions.
Yeah.
So I think we can't just assume that we're always doing enough. But thanks for sharing that. Just like to go back to what you were talking about when you were first diagnosed, because again, having watched the short film that you made with Myeloma UK, you mentioned at that time that it had been quite a shock to you when you first told some of the people close to you about your diagnosis, and it was very surprising in respect that some of the people you counted as close friends reacted really badly to the news.
Yes.
And then other people who you wouldn't necessarily have expected to be supportive turned out to be very supportive. So I was just curious as to how that was, and whether, now that you've had all those years to reflect back, what do you think was going on at that time, and what was that all about?
Well, you know, it's I'm of an age where I lived through the AIDS crisis.
Yeah.
And which has just been really well shown in the Russell T. Davis TV series. Mm. Can't remember what it was called now.
Have to Google it.
Yes. A great series, though, a real tearjerker.
Mm.
And I mean, I can remember at that time, applying for a joint mortgage with my partner then, bearing in mind that was before you could get married or have a civil relationship.
Mm.
And we had to be very, very careful about how we applied for a mortgage.
Right.
And we were asked some very intrusive questions, which they would never dream of asking now, and which we really had to tell Porky's to if we didn't want to be branded, and also have our mortgage refused.
Right.
So that was, that's just a preface, really. Time moved on a bit then, and then I got my diagnosis of myeloma, and when I remember the first couple of people that I told took a step back, shall we say, and it reminded me because my first partner was a football referee, not professional, semi-professional.
Yeah.
And so he was quite into fitness, and he really did a lot of running and lost a lot of weight. And everybody then kept asking questions about why he'd lost so much weight. You know, well, because he's a referee and he got to keep fit, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It never occurred to us at the time that there might be having suspicions about HIV and AIDS.
Right.
Not that either of us had it.
Yeah.
You know, when I then started to tell people that I had myeloma, the same thing sort of raised its head again. And so people stepped back. They didn't make any reference to HIV and AIDS, but the third friend that we told, who incidentally was Kay, automatically assumed that it was AIDS, which was a real, it was like being hit by a train a second time.
And all the more extraordinary given that
he
himself was gay. You would have thought that he would been a more enlightened.
Well, clearly not.
Yeah.
As a friend, we dropped him like a stone.
Yeah.
Because we realised he simply wasn't.
So you've seen a lot of change, John, over those years, and hopefully mostly for the positive. In general, in our local community, I mean, do you still experience a lot of prejudice on a sort of daily basis? I mean, do you feel you can be as open as you would like to be?
Throughout my life, I've been lucky enough not to experience a lot of prejudice. I think when I was at school, when I was heavily bullied. But since school, there've been rare times of prejudice. So I've been quite lucky. I've never really hidden the fact that I was gay. All my first partner, or my husband now, and we've only lived in Somerset for about 3 years. So when we moved into the village, we moved in as two men. When we introduced ourselves, Danny would introduce me as his husband, and I would do the reverse. So it was just the norm. My own attitude, the attitude of my late partner and the attitude of my husband now, has always been just to live our ordinary lives, and you don't push the fact that you're straight. We don't push the fact that we're gay. If you were out at a function with your wife, you would introduce her as your wife, and I would introduce Danny as my husband.
Yeah.
And say no more about it, and not expect to have to make any further explanations than that, really.
Well, let's hope that times are gradually changing for the better. I think in all of these things, it's two steps forward, one step back, isn't it?
Yeah, but of course, TV is having a big... it's making subtle changes. Things like the Russell T Davis drama, the fact that you have so many LGBTQ characters in all sorts of TV programmes, from EastEnders to Doctor Who, of which I'm a great fan, I've got to get that in. Subliminal, it's like subliminal marketing in a way. And people are just realising that actually, probably someone you know, even if they're not telling you at the moment, is gay.
And it just doesn't matter, or at least it just shouldn't, matter.
Yeah. And when it comes to, unfortunately, illness and cancer and life-limiting conditions, those people need to know that they're not going to be treated any differently to anybody else. Not just because the people who work for the NHS and the people who work for hospices work in those places, not just because they're a job. They're not just doing it for the money.
Absolutely.
They're doing it because they want to make a difference, and they want to support people. They want to give people a dignified passing if they're here to die.
Yeah.
And if they're not here to die, then they want to help them to live well with cancer, which is what I'm hoping to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. And both yourself and your husband have felt fully accepted at the hospice?
Absolutely, and by the local community. And just as when we were living in Worcestershire, where we lived for over 20 years, I am a Christian. I'm not a very regular church goer, but I do go to church, and I have to go to church when there aren't people there. I like to go there for the solace and just to pray on my own. But the church community, both in Worcestershire and down here in Somerset, have been extremely supportive.
Okay, that's really, really good to hear. Mm. Yeah, that's great. Okay, well, I really appreciate, John, how open you've been with us today and everything you've told us. And it's honestly a privilege to talk to you and to hear your story and to hear all the experiences you've had and what you're going through, and also the kind words that you said about the hospice. So really, from my point of view, thank you so much for coming in and for sharing and for being so generous in what you've said to us about the hospice. And really just to wish you all the very best with your stem cell treatment in July, and we hope for the longest possible period of remission after that. And is there anything else that the hospice can do to support you, or should be doing, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I'm hoping to get quite some years of remission yet. When the time comes that I am at end of life, I would like to pass away at home.
Yeah.
Ideally.
Yeah.
I'm sure that the hospice will still be there to support me in that, for which I'm grateful now and always will be.
Well, we'd be here for you every step of the way, both for you and for your husband.
Thank you.
Anything at all that we can do for you.
Can I also say, though, to anybody anybody with any type of cancer, don't mope. In that 7 years that I've had my remission, I've travelled around the world. I've been to New Zealand twice.
Wow.
Singapore, India. Done a train journey across India. We haven't let our feet touch the ground. I'm fortunate enough to be able to do those sorts of things.
Yes.
But to anybody listening, whatever however much money you've got, it's not all about money. It's also about spending time with your loved ones and with your friends.
Yeah.
And we're all learning now how good it is to have a staycation in the UK. So you don't have to travel around the world.
Absolutely.
You know, there's still plenty that you can do to enjoy life and make the most of it and make sure that what you're doing makes you happy.
Yeah, that's wise words and very good to remember.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, John. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.